It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new bill would create public funding for some renewable energy startups in Wisconsin. We'll get the details from the bill's sponsor. First, if you blinked last week amid the two major Democratic primary debates, border aid legislation, and a lot of other news, you might have missed some of the Supreme Court decisions that were handed down, some with big impacts on Wisconsin. One of those had to do with gerrymandering, or drawing legislative voting district lines to disproportionately favor one party over the other. The court ruled in a 5-4 decision that partisan gerrymandering was a matter for states to manage, not the federal court system. What does that decision mean for redistricting after the 2020 census? What does it mean for us here in Wisconsin? David Daly is a senior fellow at the nonpartisan voting advocacy organization Fair Vote. He writes about voting rights for a variety of publications, and he's the author of a book subtitled The True Story of the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, remind us how this Supreme Court vote went down last week.
It was a crushing blow for those of us who are passionate about voting rights. It was a 5-4 decision that essentially broke down along ideological lines, the five conservative justices on one side, the four liberal justices on the other. And essentially what the court said in an opinion written by the Chief Justice, John Roberts, is that gerrymandering is non-justiciable, meaning that it is not an issue that the federal courts have the ability to determine. The Chief Justice essentially, as you said, kicked this back to Congress and to the states and said this is a political issue and the federal courts have no business determining how much politics is too much politics in the drawing of legislative maps.
And this is what they call partisan gerrymandering, meaning you're maximizing one party's votes over the other. We saw a case of Democratic and Republican gerrymandering going to the courts here. Still, racial gerrymandering, that would still be under the, purview of the federal court system, right?
That's exactly right. So you had two cases here, both of them having to do with partisan gerrymandering, one of them from North Carolina, in which Republicans drew lines that essentially locked in 10 of the state's 13 congressional districts for their side. And then you had a case out of Maryland in which the Democrats essentially turned Maryland's 6th district completely inside out. They moved in some 340,000 voters, shifting them in and out of that district in order to turn a 6-2 Democratic advantage there into a 7-1 Democratic edge.
And here in Wisconsin, we've seen some fallout after this vote. There was a group of Democratic voters. They had had a court case moving up and then briefly back down in the federal court system. They've dropped that now on the basis of this court decision. It wasn't directly about Wisconsin's case. Is that a big deal that we've stopped this lawsuit now here in Wisconsin?
I think it's a huge deal. You had three other cases that were lined up at the Supreme Court. There were federal courts all across the country and bipartisan panels of judges appointed by both Democratic presidents as well as Republican presidents that had been declaring maps tainted by partisan intent to be unconstitutional. You also had cases in Michigan and in Ohio as well as Wisconsin. And as soon as the Supreme Court essentially slammed the federal courthouse doors to these cases, the other three cases effectively died. And we saw what happened in Wisconsin in 2018. It was a pretty good year for the Democrats in 2018. Democrats took over the governor's office. They reelected a Democratic U.S. senator. They won all of the statewide offices. And they won some 200,000 more votes than Republicans for the state assembly. And yet Democrats were only able to pick up one additional seat and to cut the Republican edge from down to 63-36. So effectively, because of partisan gerrymandering, Democrats won 53% of the vote, but they were only able to turn that into 35% of the seats. That map is now going to continue to be in place in Wisconsin through 2020, and then it will be a redrawn after the census in 2021.
Talking to David Daly with the group Fair Vote about a Supreme Court case, U.S. Supreme Court case on partisan gerrymandering, how we draw political voting lines and how it affects elections. David, does this, in effect, as you see it, disenfranchise voters, take away the power of people's votes?
I think it clearly does. Gerrymandering really is cheating. It is an ability of partisans to draw lines that entrench themselves in power, that limit the ability of the other side to elect members of their own choosing, to turn a majority of votes into a majority of seats. And then it helps insulate them in office once they're there. And this is politicians of both parties. So whoever does this is essentially using the power to draw the lines to make the rules. It determines winners and losers for a decade. It makes our elections less competitive. It sends politicians to office who are more extreme and less likely to seek compromises. And it really distorts policy outcomes in states. This is a toxic problem for our democracy. And the Supreme Court had it teed up right in front of them, the ability to do something about this. They had federal courts from around the country saying, we do believe that this is a serious problem, and we also believe that we have the tools to handle and manage it. Let us do something about it, especially on the verge of the next round of redistricting. And instead, the Supreme Court said no.
Now, the Supreme Court, the majority there said, even if you agree that this is a problem, they say it's not a problem for the federal courts to solve. They pointed toward a few other methods of fixing things that people want to. One that we can't do here in Wisconsin, having a citizen referendum to change the way lines are drawn. You see problems with that, at least as it's worked out in other states.
Well, I think that independent commissions can work very well. The trouble is, as you mentioned, in Wisconsin, they're not allowed. So this is ballot initiatives that would take the power to draw lines away from politicians and give them back to citizens is not a route that voters in Wisconsin have in front of them. And the justices kept talking about the possibility of ballot initiatives as if this was something that voters could do across the entire country. It's not. There are only a small handful of states left where this is even possible. What this effectively does is it leaves it up to Congress and state legislatures now to try and find a solution. And this is a lot like asking looters to regulate looting. These are the people who drew the lines. They have no incentive to make any change, especially when those are the lines that keep them in power and insulate them from voters. It's going to be very, very difficult now to prevent politicians from essentially embarking on a festival of unfettered partisan gerrymandering in 2021.
You also have written in a couple of op-eds lately that even when states do go to independent commissions to draw these lines as opposed to the legislature, there have been lawsuits filed by members of legislatures that could see success in overturning those independent commissions down the road, maybe in the U.S. Supreme Court.
That's exactly right, which is another reason why I think it may have been disingenuous for the Chief Justice to be suggesting that independent commissions provided a way out of this. There is an independent commission in Arizona that the citizens set up there through constitutional amendment back in 2000. And after the 2011 cycle, Republicans in the state legislature sued, and they essentially said that this was an unconstitutional commission because it took the power to draw these lines from the legislature, and it violated the Elections Clause of the Constitution, which essentially vests that power in the legislature. And you had a 5-4 court at the time barely uphold the constitutionality of the Arizona Commission in a 2015 case. Justice Roberts was in the four at the time, and this was one of his most scathing dissents that he ever delivered on the bench. And Justice Kennedy at the time was the swing vote that essentially upheld the constitutionality of these commissions. But now that Justice Kennedy is gone, it is a very different court. It is entirely possible that this question could come back to the U.S. a Supreme Court on independent commissions sometime in the next decade. And there is, you know, certainly no sense that the Chief Justice has changed his mind on this, and the court could deliver a very different opinion and overturn Arizona.
Talking to David Daly, senior fellow at Fair Vote, a nonpartisan voting advocacy organization. He's the author of a book on the topic of gerrymandering and related issues. We'll go to your calls now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Yeah, hi. I grew up in Chicago in the 60s and 70s. And when I moved to Wisconsin, I was shocked to see what I call gerrymandering that would make a Daily Machine Democrat blush. For the last 8 years, we've seen voting in Wisconsin pretty much go towards Democrats, but none of that is reflected in our Senate or our Assembly. I think it's way overdue for people to have a much fairer way of deciding who votes in what district.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. David, for someone like Tom who wants to see things change, what can they do?
That's a great question. I mean, now that the federal courts have been closed and without the ability to do a ballot initiative, the options are closing on people in Wisconsin if they want to fight for their a democracy. There is still the possibility of a challenge at the state level, and state court challenges to gerrymandering have indeed proven to be successful during this decade. In Pennsylvania, you had a Republican gerrymander that locked in 13 of the state's 18 congressional districts for the GOP, and the court there overturned that as an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander under protections of voting rights that are enshrined in the state constitution, which are much more robust than the federal constitution, where those protections simply don't exist. And a new map came into play there in the fall elections, and it produced 9 Republicans and 9 Democrats, exactly the kind of result that you would imagine. The trouble with that approach as well is that state Supreme Courts are elected, and they too can prove to be partisan bodies. So, you know, I don't necessarily think that a challenge in Wisconsin's Supreme Court, which itself has become a bit of a partisan institution, would necessarily be a viable and a successful one.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We'll go to Brent now in Peshtigo. Brent, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think, Brent?
Well, I've got thoughts about the state and the federal level. Here in Wisconsin, where our assembly districts, there's 3 for every Senate district, it would be fairly easy for us to create some sort of proportional representation system to try to minimize the effect of gerrymandering. You'd still have gerrymandering of the Senate district, but at least with the 3 assembly districts, we could do some form of proportional election, proportional representation. At the federal level, one of the problems, it seems to me, is that we have this locked-in number for the House of Representatives, which has been locked in for almost a century, and the original proposed First Amendment in the Bill of Rights was to create sort of an algorithm to increase the size of Congress as the population of the United States increased, and as the original Second Amendment was revised and eventually passed 200 years later, maybe that's something we should look at doing, is trying to pass that first Amendment and bring it back to life to at least force Congress to increase in size.
Brent, thanks for the call. Interesting ideas, David. They might both be long shots, though, to try to make them happen.
I think they are long shots, but I think that this is a time for long shots. I mean, I think that it's going to take really creative ideas like that if we are going to try and salvage a democracy in an era of radical polarization like this. I think that, you know, some kind of a movement towards proportional representation makes a perfect sense. There's a great bill from a Virginia congressman named Don Beyer called the Fair Representation Act, which would do exactly that. And also that, you know, thinking about perhaps how we enlarge the size of the House in order to, you know, take on modern population challenges also perhaps ought to be one of the things we are thinking about.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to David Daly, senior fellow at Fair Vote, about partisan district maps, gerrymandering, U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to that practice. Now it's up to the states to act or not on the issue. Back to your calls now. We'll go to Jeff in West Salem. Jeff, hi. Jeff, are you there?
I'm here, but I'm not Jeff.
Okay. Who do we have? Oh, we've got Nate in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Thank you very
Jeff,
much.
Hang on over there. Nate, go ahead.
Sure. I was going to ask about two things. First, what federal options do we have to pass legislation, considering that some of the House of Representatives folks are from gerrymandered districts? So they've benefited from using gerrymandering to rig elections themselves. And second, correct me if I'm wrong, but the lower courts were very strongly coming out against gerrymandering. So it's not just that the Supreme Court took a step on a divided issue. It's that there was a wave of lower court rulings coming against gerrymandering, and they pulled the rug out from under it.
Nate, thanks for the call. David.
Yes, that's exactly right. There was a torrent, really, of lower federal courts that all agreed that not only was partisan gerrymandering a serious constitutional problem, but that they had the tools to measure when politicians went too far and that they felt perfectly comfortable doing so. And, you know, those cases came out of maps in Wisconsin and North Carolina and Michigan and in Ohio and Maryland. And the Supreme Court did exactly that. It pulled the rug out from under them and it slammed the door of the federal courthouse. I think you are also right about the challenges facing the ability to pass legislation on this. We are asking members of Congress or members of state legislatures who were themselves elected from gerrymandered districts to do something about this. I mean, it's an ultimate fox guarding the hen house, and it is very, very difficult to imagine how those legislators are going to do something about this.
Nate, thanks.
One of the things – I'm sorry.
I was going to bring on another caller now. Nate, thanks for the call. We'll go to Jeff for real now in West Salem. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. This whole gerrymandering thing is so frustrating. It's like, you know, I'm liberal, but if it was in favor of the Democrats, I wouldn't be in favor of it either. To me, it's got to be direct representation. How you can take a map and draw it so one-sided that it's like if you took a person, let's just hypothetically say from a different planet, so this is how we do things. It's just unbelievable to me. I can't imagine our forefathers, you know, had this in mind. You know, it's just when you rig it for one side or the other, it's wrong. And if you know, I'm liberal, and if we were in power and doing it, I would say it's wrong. And I just don't see how conservatives, Republicans can justify this. And I'll hang up with your comments. Thank you very much.
Jeff, thanks for the call. David, do you see enough principled objections on both sides to this practice where it could change someday?
I wish I did. I think that, you know, Democrats were perfectly in favor of much of this partisan gerrymandering for years when it benefited them in states like California and Texas. Democrats had the opportunity to do something about this, you know, back when they had control of Congress and complete control of government back in the first term of the Obama administration, and they didn't do anything about it then either. It is a toxic, horrible problem that both parties recognize sort of, but neither one is perfectly willing to ignore and do anything about. And I think one of the things that makes it so difficult now is that the technology is so good and the data is so precise that today's gerrymanders are not like the gerrymanders of other decades, which sometimes could be undone naturally or could be undone at the ballot box. These are surgically drawn. And when you look at the data and the algorithms that the consultants in Wisconsin, for example, used to draw these state legislative districts, they knew exactly what they were doing. And they very carefully constructed a map that would always give Republicans a majority of seats, even if they won 42-43% of the vote statewide. And they're able to do that now. thanks to the computer technology, thanks to the mapping software, thanks to all of this voter data that is available. It's easy and it's fast. It's high tech. And that's what makes it so much more dangerous than gerrymanders in any other time.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
We've been talking to David Daly, senior fellow at Fair Vote, author of a book on gerrymandering and related issues. We talked with him about the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision leaving issues of gerrymandering, of drawing partisan political districts to the states, what that means for Wisconsin and the country as a whole. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has formally encouraged energy efficiency and renewable energy projects around the state since 2001 as part of its Focus on Energy program. That initiative works to foster a statewide commitment to clean energy by citing financial incentives and the potential for job creation. A new bill presented in the Wisconsin legislature aims to build on that and give the state's renewable energy economy another boost. Katrina Shankland is a Democratic state representative from Stevens Point. She's the lead sponsor on the bill. Representative Shankland, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll start us off, please, with the basics. What would your legislation do?
Sure. So this bill would create a Wisconsin Renewable Energy Development Authority. And what it would do is really spur and foster growth in the clean energy sector. We already know that clean energy jobs are difficult to outsource, they're well-paying, and they're growing faster than the average job in Wisconsin or across the nation. And in fact, solar jobs, for example, employ veterans at a much higher rate than many other industries. And these are just fantastic jobs that really not only strengthen our economy and support working families, but also help our environment and help us mitigate global climate change. So when it comes to clean and renewable energy, I believe the state needs to do much more than we're doing right now. And there are at least six states that have green banks. And this bill, instead of creating a green bank, creates an authority of the state, which is an independent public entity. We have a couple other state authorities like WEDA and WEFA that help steer investment in housing and economic development. And what the WEDA, the Wisconsin Renewable Energy Development Authority, would do is not only operate loan and loan guarantee programs, but also grant programs, equity financing programming, provide technical assistance, oversee environmental credits, and acquire technology licenses. So basically, virtually in any way, how can the state help with investing in renewable energy? This is what RETA will do. They'll make these decisions, and it will be governed by an 11-member board from many different sectors, including agriculture, including economic development, research, and many others. So I'm excited that this bill is getting attention and people are talking about it. I've had some people working on renewable energy reach out to me across the state since I reintroduced it this session just a few weeks ago. I'm looking forward to continuing talking about the need to invest in renewable energy.
Where would the funding for these grants and loans come from?
So the revolving loan program would essentially pay for itself after an initial seed investment. And the seed investment would come from state dollars, just like we do with the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority. So this bill is modeled after that. And just to give you an example of the impact that the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority has had, since 1972, they've helped 73,000 people rent a home and 122,000 people buy a home. They have $2 billion in assets and $10.8 billion in bonding. And that's just because the state legislature decided to commit to making housing more affordable. And in that time, they've also expanded to small business and agricultural loans to help people. So while this is a new idea when it comes to fostering growth, tremendous growth in clean energy, the way the bill is modeled, the way that RETA is set up, is not new in that it would create a state authority subject to the same kind of regulations like open records law and public protections in place of taxpayer dollars, while also allowing a board to steer investments in clean energy and foster the kind of research we need to really generate not only family-supporting jobs, but ways to protect and promote clean energy and our environment.
We're talking to Representative Katrina Shankland. She's a Democratic representative from Stevens Point, talking about her bill presented in the state legislature. It's aimed at boosting the state's renewable energy economy by providing, as we're hearing, grants and loans through a renewable energy development authority modeled on a couple other agencies that do similar work, but in other areas in the state. We are talking about that plan. And Representative Shankland, can you talk a little bit about how this would differ from the already existing Focus on Energy program?
Sure. So Focus on Energy has incentives that ratepayers essentially pay for by, you know, when they pay their electric bill every month, the utilities have money set aside that they put into Focus on Energy. And so if you, for example, want to buy some LEDs, you can get a Focus on Energy incentive. Or if you want to look into energy efficient washers and dryers, you could look into whether or not you qualify for a Focus on Energy incentive. So in addition, Focus on Energy in the past has had really robust rebate programs and incentive programs for solar and for wind. And that's changed over time. I actually used to work at the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, where we helped people connect with Focus on Energy and determine whether or not they were eligible for an incentive, and then kind of pass along the information for them to connect directly. So Focus on Energy is utility funded, and it helps businesses, farms, schools, homeowners, and renters. And it's really focused primarily on energy efficiency. The difference here is the Wisconsin Renewable Energy Development Authority would steer large-scale investments in research in new technology and existing technology that might need a quick innovation in things like, let's talk about battery storage, for example. What can we do when it comes to long-term solutions for battery storage as it relates to clean energy? Let's talk about clean energy infrastructure as it relates to solar car charging stations, for example. So really, this is looking at the big ideas and the big picture, and how can the state of Wisconsin help the good ideas that are already happening become even better ideas, and how can we help spur entrepreneurs and investors in leading the nation in clean energy technology? Because right now, Wisconsin is really taking a back seat to other states when it comes to solar and wind, when about a decade ago, we were really in the game.
If there's a demand for this, and we're seeing it get more economical over time nationwide and worldwide, why does the state need to be involved at all?
Well, the state has a responsibility to promote things that not only help its citizens, but also are what I would say help us tackle global climate change. As we look at tourism dollars that will be lost, agricultural dollars that will be lost, economic dollars that will be lost with the long-term effects of climate change as it worsens, we can actually have an effect on that. We have a responsibility to invest in renewable energy and to mitigate our carbon emissions. And investing in renewable energy, especially in long-term technological solutions like solar car charging stations across the state, for example, is one way that we can meet that commitment. I'd also point out that, you know, fossil fuels have been subsidized by corporate or by the government for a very long time. And I think it's our responsibility to look at ways to make sure that we are not just subsidizing fossil fuels, but we're also transitioning to a long-term sustainable solution, both for our energy economy and our natural resources. We send about $16 billion of our energy money out of the state to places like Wyoming to buy coal, but we'd have a much greater economic impact on our state and economy if we were to spend more of our energy dollars here. And part of that means we need to invest in renewable energy instead of sending our money out of state.
You're introducing this as a Democrat. Republicans control both chambers of the legislature. Have you heard support from the majority party?
I haven't yet, but I went back to 2013 when I first introduced this legislation, the 2013-14 session, and I'll note that back then, Senator Dale Schultz did co-sponsor this, and that gives me some hope because he and I sat on a clean energy panel and talked about the need for bipartisan legislation to invest in renewable energy. So it's 6 years later, we're getting some attention from people who are really interested in investing in renewable energy because it does make economic sense. It's fiscally responsible, and I think that this is the kind of solution that I would hope to see both Republicans and Democrats get behind. Right now, it's only sponsored by Democratic legislators, but I'm committed to talking about this issue and getting folks on board, because even if you just look at new jobs, green occupations, clean energy jobs like solar installers, wind turbine service technicians, environmental engineers, these jobs are growing. They're growing quickly and they're well-paying jobs. So there is an economic component to this in addition to an environmental one that I think my colleagues can get behind. And so I'll do everything I can to raise awareness about this bill and see if they're interested.
Representative Shanklin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Representative Katrina Shanklin, Democratic State Representative from Stevens Point. She joined us today for a look at her new legislation aimed at boosting renewable energy in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Federal officials are looking into posts in a private Facebook group for current and former Border Patrol employees. ProPublica reported on the group yesterday. It says the posts include vile remarks and memes about migrants and members of Congress. And there are sexually explicit images that were edited to include New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Democrats, including Ocasio-Cortez, are calling for the agents to be fired. Their demand came on the same day they toured detention facilities on the U.S.-Mexico border following reports of squalid conditions. Ocasio-Cortez told Reuters what she saw wasn't pretty.
There's abuse in these facilities. There's abuse. This was them on their best behavior, and they put them in a room with no running water, and these women were being told by CBP officers to drink out of the toilet.
Border Patrol officials denied the accusations. Sarah Ferris is a congressional reporter for Politico. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, starting with this private Facebook group, what do we know about who's in it and what kind of things are being posted there?
So right now, all we have is this report from ProPublica that talks about thousands of current and former officials. We don't know exactly the identities of everyone in this group, of course, but ProPublica did verify that several of those who have posted in the group, including some of the very inflammatory, at times, really explicit images in this group, are current members of Border Patrol Agency. Now, the agency officials have been quick to condemn the behavior. They've launched their own investigation into the current officials that may or may not have been responsible for these posts. This is something they say they are taking seriously, but Democrats who've already been really concerned about what's happening at the border, this is an issue that flared up on Capitol Hill last week. They're really seizing on this and leaning in hard, going into their own investigations, looking to bring a lot of attention to this issue, which has generated public outrage really across the country over the last few days.
Now, there have been multiple reports about conditions at these facilities from the AP. We're seeing pictures, apparently, from the Inspector General in the Department of Homeland Security. First of all, can you talk about which facilities we're talking about here? There are Homeland Security facilities. There are Health and Human Services facilities. What is at the center of all this?
That's right. Well, the Inspector General's report that just came out today, that looks at a facility in Texas that's run by Customs and Border Patrol. Now, this agency, as you mentioned, is one of only a few that are responding. The Health and Human Services Department officials have been mostly responsible for just the unaccompanied minors. The Border Patrol, that has a much larger array of people that it's trying to oversee. And at this facility, we saw not only adult men who are detained in these tightly packed rooms, we also saw mothers and children who are appearing to try to sleep on concrete floors. They have these space blankets that look like these aluminum blankets. A really shocking scene for in the United States for people to be living like this for at some points there's weeks at a time. So the images that just came out of the Inspector General's report have already prompted the House Oversight Committee to announce hearings. So they're going to be, this is a very big step. We've been waiting for the Democrats in the House to formally announce this. They're looking to bring in a pair of top Homeland Security officials to testify in the next 2 weeks or so. And this will be a chance to really bring this to the public forefront. They've been looking to do this for a few weeks now.
Leading up to that, we have this tour of some of these facilities by Democratic members of Congress. Set the stage for us. This was a tense scene.
Right. So this was organized by the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. This is the group on Capitol Hill that's really been leading the charge trying to demand some conditions. They want to have stricter oversight. They want the Trump administration to really clean up its act here. So the Congressional Hispanic Caucus invited more than a dozen House members. Many of them are freshmen. They haven't been to the border before. And they took a tour of these facilities that have been criticized as overcrowded and having some at some points even inhumane conditions, depriving people of hot meals and showers. And what they saw was actually not the kind of images that we've been picturing that if you look on the news, you might see, because members of Congress have to give 2 days notice before they go on these tours. So the facilities basically have time to make sure that they're not going to be showing members of Congress a scene that wouldn't look good on CNN or on a cable news show. So that they've really, we've talked to some members on that trip, and they said it felt like the facilities tried to show us a scene of orderliness. They wanted to show that they had everything under control. Now, the members talked to people afterwards who had been in those conditions, and they said that that was not the reality that they had faced in the last few weeks. They said that they hadn't had access to showers, to hot meals. Some members of Congress are coming back to the Hill next week with a different picture, and they're going to be looking to do even more aggressive oversight.
Talking to Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter for Politico, about detention centers at the U.S. border, controversies surrounding them, concerns about conditions, Democratic members of Congress visiting those facilities, and a secret Facebook group of apparently current and former Border Patrol agents and officials with some shocking content on it. I want to give a listen to Border Patrol Chief of Operations Brian Hastings on CNN yesterday. Here's what he had to say in part in response to Democrats' criticism of these border facilities.
We're professionals. We're dealing with a crisis right now. Over 680,000 apprehensions so far this year. Agents are under a great deal of stress, but with that, what I would remind the public is how many rescues the men and women of Border Patrol have done and put their life on the line to save various individuals throughout the year.
Sarah, one thing I hear that I think people all over this story agree on is there's a lot of people here. The agents there are overwhelmed by what they're trying to deal with, and there are calls for various sorts of fixes to that. But everybody agrees the system right now doesn't seem to be working.
That's right. And what the agents have been saying they need the most is money. And they finally got that last week. The House and Senate agreed to pass a nearly $5 billion package that will deliver some of this much needed funds to the border. And that will be both Border Patrol, that's to the HHS officials at Health and Human Services Department. So this money will be going to them in the next few weeks. That will certainly help with addressing the shortage of food and shelter in some places. But of course, there's a far larger issues that Democrats and Republicans have been struggling to deal with, and we don't really have a clear path of how they will address that in the future. So this is probably going to be dominating discussions, not only of the upcoming funding season. Of course, Congress has to agree on a funding bill, including on how to fund the Department of Homeland Security, and these issues are sure to come up. But in the meantime, the funding bill, the most recent funding bill, is out the door, and there's a couple of weeks before the next fiscal showdown really hits the Hill.
What are some of the decisions by this large number of people in detention facilities right now? This is not always the way we deal with large numbers of people at the border, as I understand it.
Well, there have been various ways of responding as the influx of migrants at the border has ebbed and flowed over the years. In the most recent Inspector General's report, it showed that there was over 100% increase this year of people who have been apprehended at the border. Now, of course, 124% to be precise. Now, these apprehensions are really straining agencies both at the Border Patrol. There's also been a 62% increase in unaccompanied alien children. And so when a child comes across the border without a parent, it places even a greater strain on the agency because you have to provide translation services, you have to provide legal services. And this is something that the government just hasn't been equipped to do. We haven't seen levels like this since 2014 or so, when the Obama administration struggled with much of the same problem. So you have these temporary detention facilities. The government is furiously trying to create new ways to hold people and to shelter people in a way that doesn't, just offer another prison-like setting. But it's very difficult to do because these things do ebb and flow, and the numbers have fluctuated greatly over the last 5 years or so.
What are you watching for now in Congress when it comes to these issues? You were starting to touch on that earlier.
That's right. So the big after this border funding fight resolved last week, and it resolved in a very tense way, there are a lot of progressive Democrats, members of the Hispanic caucus, who are very angry about the way that things ended. They did not secure a lot of the protections that they wanted for these migrant children, as well as for their parents and other adults crossing the border. So I think we're going to see a lot of this pent-up frustration resurface in the next several weeks. As I mentioned earlier, House Democrats are already announcing a hearing where they're going to try to bring in the acting head of the Department of Homeland Security. They want to bring in the acting commissioner of the Border Patrol agency. So they have a lot of things on their agenda, and I think a lot of it will be progressive Democrats just demanding that the Trump administration and the White House are providing them with details about how the situation will improve. They want to make sure that if there are children who do die in U.S. custody, that they're aware of this and they have a plan to make sure it doesn't happen again. And actually, just as we've been speaking, the Speaker Nancy Pelosi just announced that she spoke with President Trump last week for 14 minutes. They talked about the treatment of migrant children and families. She sent a follow-up letter today, including three bullet points of exactly how to improve some of these conditions for children. So these are ways that the House Democrats are trying to get a hold of the situation and exert more of their really flex more muscle that they with President Trump here on when they feel that his department is failing these children and some of the other people who've been detained at these facilities.
Briefly getting back to these congressional visits, I understand one of the provisions that progressive Democrats had wanted was the ability to visit these sites without that 48-hour notice. That's one of those things that was ultimately dropped. Is that right?
That's right. And actually, that same condition has been a part of bipartisan spending bills in the past. So Republicans and Democrats last year had agreed that they wanted this kind of access. And of course, it's something that being able to go there unannounced, it's just like a health inspector going to visit a restaurant. They don't want these facilities to have time to clean up their act. They want to see how it really is. Which is, we saw a glimpse of that in the Inspector General's report today. And so I think Democrats are going to keep pushing for that. They'll be able to make another push for that in the upcoming spending bill. That won't get resolved until September or so. So I think that'll be something to watch for sure.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks so much.
That's Sarah Ferris, congressional reporter who covers the U.S. House for Politico. We talked with her about congressional Democrats' tour of border facilities on the U.S.-Mexico border. Today is World UFO Day. If you're looking for UFOs this summer, Wisconsin is only sort of the place to be. The website satelliteinternet.com ranked the states by UFO sightings per capita as reported to the National UFO Reporting Center's online database. Now, mind you, UFO doesn't mean alien intelligence. To be an unidentified flying object, you need A, an object, B, that's flying, C, you don't know what it is. Anyhow, rank the states from top to bottom, and Wisconsin is right there in the middle at number 23. The top five, Washington, Montana, Vermont, Alaska, Maine, that's a mixed bag. The least likely states per capita to report UFOs, Texas, Louisiana, Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, all in the south. This means something, people. I'm surprised Wisconsin isn't higher on the list. A, we have the big annual experimental aircraft show, Air Venture, later this month in Oshkosh. Some of those aircraft always look pretty unidentifiable to me. Two, we have not one, but two UFO capitals in Wisconsin, Elmwood and Campbellsport. Elmwood hosts UFO Days later this month on the 27th and 28th. Campbellsport hosts UFO Days, D-A-Z-E, on July 20th. And this just in, I saw references to Belleville hosting a UFO event later this year. And we talked to someone about a documentary about UFO sightings in Dundee, Wisconsin. Where is the real UFO capital of the state? The truth is out there.